I can go. Okay. Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld. I'm here with Neil Gore, who's putting on this incredible conference called The Portal to Ascension. It's in San Diego, April 21st to the 23rd, 2023. We have one of our keynote speakers with us today, Robert Edward Grant. And I'm really excited about going deep into his work because I'll talk to him. I don't call him a polymath. I call him someone who's connecting the dots of the complete reality that we're existing in. So, but before we go there, Neil, why don't you give us a little overview of what the whole conference in San Diego is about?
Yes, for sure. Hello, everybody. Welcome. And I'm excited for today because we're actually starting a series of interviews with speakers for our conference, starting with Robert Edward Grant. And we've announced it a few times. But Robert just asked just a few minutes ago as well, just what is the overall mission of Portal to Ascension? What are we doing? What have we created? And the intention, and you know, we feel that it's a good way to start out this conversation here is to really talk about how we got to where we are today. And I've told, I've shared this a few times before, but we did start around 2008. And in, 2008, Portal to Ascension started with small sound healing groups. It was really after 8 years of deep rabbit hole research and just going into ancient history and really trying to look for the root of all religion, where it all came from. And in 2008, after creating a Facebook group and all these individuals joining and sharing information, I decided to create Portal to Ascension and started with small, sound healing events up and down the coast from San Diego all the way to Vancouver. And by 2010, I started experimenting with conferences. And the intention always was like, the reason why all this started, the reason why this conference is happening is because my original thought of like, what is the root of all religion? And by looking for the root of all religion, because I saw there were so many similarities in all these ancient scriptures, right? From Christian to Jesus to so many different stories, the Sumerian scriptures being reiterated over and over. Why is it that so many people speak about what makes us different rather than the what makes us the same and the similarities between ancient texts, even though the information isn't even hidden in plain sight, it's right in front of us, right? So that started making me look deeper and deeper down. That took me to the extraterrestrial questions, sacred geometry, consciousness, and then eventually the understanding that we are going through a shift in consciousness and that we've gone through these shifts, these devolutions and evolutions so many times. And from that original intent, we've now created over 5,000 productions since 2008. Wow. Online events, live conferences, retreats, tours. And for the last 3 years, we've been silent with events, right? Because we could not do live conferences in the way we did before. So this event is huge for many reasons, because it's the return of Portal Ascension live events after, and we have a series of live events this year in Vegas and Sedona and UK. So it's really a celebration of us coming together and connecting in oneness, and also riding the wave of the fact that this awareness has picked up on a whole new level, especially this year, like with all the events going on, all the people taking people to Egypt and so much occurring, that it's really time for us to come together and make some real change, create some networks and connection so that we can shift this paradigm, because there's really no holding back anymore. This is game time. This is the time we came here, to be here and what to do. So now that's my long story of why we do what we do. And I'm excited to bring together these people. So I'm gonna hand it over to Alan to officially introduce Robert Edward Grant in a second. But these individuals that we have at this conference, we really dive deep into their awareness in order to kind of like select the ones that we resonated with so much to create a full circle awareness. Like, you come to this event, music, entertainment, education, ancient history, extraterrestrial awareness, consciousness, so many different aspects, and all of them are different modalities, if you will, to take you to that ultimate truth of us all being interconnected. So hope to see you guys there. AscensionConference.com is the website. And you can also tune in virtually if you can't attend live. So that's the
long
story.
Well, you got me excited. I want to go right now.
Well, you're a big part of everything Neil mentioned, ancient civilization, symbology, music, and what the future really holds for human civilization. So that's really where I want to jump in on this conversation, because I've watched your videos, some of them, to just get my understanding of your work. And what I found there was a passion for what I would call the implicate order of David Bohm. You are looking for the underlying structure. That's what I saw. And where did this passion emerge from? How, you know, we're all grow up, normal childhood somewhat. And then when did you ignite that passion for connecting the dots? I'm just curious.
You know, I think I can't remember when I didn't have that passion for connecting the dots. You know, the thing is that it's hard to say and hard to see also how the dots connect until you can see them in the retrospect. And I think that was a quote that was given by Steve Jobs at a graduation ceremony he was basically speaking at Stanford University. You need some years under your belt to see how the dots connect. And then you can see how they all connect and create many beautiful patterns. It's like a tapestry or a mosaic that you didn't know what it was because you're just looking at all these individual puzzle pieces without seeing how there's a connectedness to the entire whole. And it reminds me of Leonardo da Vinci's quote, where he said, "Learn how to see, realize that everything connects to everything else." And I think that's such a powerful thing. You know, we tend to think we're very separate from the rest of the world around us. We don't see how we brush our teeth in the morning connects to the rest of our day. And we don't see how we ourselves, through this infinite vacuum space, are actually connected to everybody else through the same consciousness of this beautiful universe that is really just another way of looking at monadicity, of oneness. And I'm very excited about what's happening in the world right now because the consciousness shift is dramatic and swift. I think it's much faster than even I could have comprehended. It would have been only a few years ago. And it's exciting to see people really realizing that they are part of a connected whole. And when you're part of that connected whole, then you see how the dots connect every single day in every single moment.
So I think part of this consciousness shift is what you point out a lot in your work. We're seeing new patterns, the patterns of perception. What are these new patterns you're seeing that is amplifying this acceleration of consciousness from your
perspective? Well, you know, during COVID, one of the things that was kind of interesting is that QR codes took off in their usage, right? Because we all went to the restaurant, there were no more menus. So we had to use our phones to figure out how to like read our menus. And that actually was a good metaphor for what's happening with us with geometry right now. Every time we take into our consciousness a new geometric form or pay attention to it, it's literally a QR code for our subconscious mind. It is raising our consciousness without us even knowing it. It will have a subtle impact. And really all these higher dimensions of perception are all in the subtle realms. It's not like in your face type stuff. You know, if we were flatlanders and someone came to us and tried to describe to us what the depth perception would be, right, which would be a Z-axis when you looked at sort of a Cartesian plane in three dimensions, then it would be difficult to explain it because you'd have to use the words from only a two-dimensional word to describe what someone else is seeing and feeling. And right. I think what's happening right now is that en masse, people are starting to be able to perceive these subtle realms of consciousness that they couldn't experience before. And some do it simply by studying geometry. Some actually get there through psychedelics and other means to be able to sort of shortchange or sort of skip a few rungs on the ladder. But eventually, everybody is going to be able to see some of these aspects of higher dimensional perception just because of where the Earth is in the solar system and where the solar system is in the galactic, sort of cycle around our central sun, which is actually not just our sun, Helios, but actually the galactic center, the galactic disk.
Yeah, you know, you talked about new patterns, new geometries. This is why I love crop circles, because I felt whoever's doing it from whatever level, they're giving us new patterns that start to encode and wake up a deeper neurological connection. Have you looked at the crop circles?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I wasn't even aware of until somebody who goes by the name of Spirit Stem, her name is Melissa, and she's on Instagram, was following me, and she's definitely an avid crop circle follower, like very much into it. And she started noticing a pattern between the artwork that I was posting on social media when I would post a particular drawing within the next day, if it was during crop circle season, which is generally during the spring and summer and sort of early fall months. That the same crop circle of a very similar drawing would appear in Wiltshire, England, or in France. And this happened now 17 times in the last 3 years. And so it caused me, because I wasn't even aware of it. She was just pointing it out. She said, you posted this last night on Instagram at like midnight, your time. And then 5 hours later, it was discovered as a crop circle in you know, Southern England. And that's kind of like something that really turned me on to it. So I started really looking into it. My colleague, Alan Green, and I started analyzing some of the crop circles. You may remember about a year or so ago, there was a crop circle that looked very Freemason style. Mm-hmm. And we analyzed that, and it was most definitely a Freemason symbol that later we were able to sort of decode. There was another symbology that was looked like a Vesca Piscis, but it was slightly modified from a Vesca Piscis. And we analyzed that. We were able to decode that too, that there were messages in this. And so I started thinking, well, in the case where I was drawing these symbologies and they were showing up as crop circles, either I had kind of some overzealous followers in somewhere in Southern England and in France, or maybe there's something else going on. And it actually made me think of patents. You know, I have about 60 patents, and I just got, well, I just got another one I didn't know about. I thought I had one here, but I actually have two that just came in. And these patents, you know, are interesting because it's been many times that I filed patents that another person somewhere around the world files a patent on the same day for the same invention.
Right.
So then we have some sort of dispute sometimes. And so it makes me wonder, it's like, how did they come up with the same idea at the exact same time? How is this even possible? And when you start digging into it, you find that it's a lot more common than you think. People that have never met from halfway around the planet in Russia and the United States will end up putting forward a patent of the exact same invention at the exact same time. I believe it's because our brains are not storage devices, rather they're radio receivers. And our heart is the tuning dial for those radio receivers. So when we tune in to these higher frequencies, we will start picking up things like new inventions. I don't believe that our thoughts emanate from our brains. They're literally non-local to our brain. And right. I think the same is happening often with crop circles. And I think probably some of the ETs are helping to get them in place as well.
Yeah. When I
some fake ones also, let's be real. There's probably some fake crop circles out there, but I mean, when I see some of these ones that are crazy complex, I'm like, come on, how is that going to be?
But you know, even some of those fake ones, some of those guys who fake it said, I don't know where I got that idea to fake it in this shape. So there's this.
Right. They're just crop circle slaves to some, you know, larger consciousness.
Well, maybe all of us actually are, right?
We're, yeah.
What your designs are coming through from this higher level, the patterns and the creative flow is the spirit really that's being downloaded into the physical form in a sense, it seems like. So, but what do you think is behind the crop? Is there a force? You think it's ET? You think it's a manifestation of a collective consciousness as far as crop circles?
I think that it's a manifestation. I mean, I definitely believe in ETs, and I've had experiences that I've talked about with them as well. But, and I don't even call them, you know, it's like we. It's funny because we talk about extraterrestrial, and maybe probably the better way to term them would be intraterrestrial. You know, they've been here all along. And, you know, I think what's probably happening right now is that they've all been, and many of them have been in higher dimension. And as we can start to perceive higher dimension, we could start to perceive them. We could start to experience them. And they also, my experience with them is that they're very spiritual and they believe in sort of a universal oneness as well. And you can almost think of them like Jedi Knights, you know. In fact, Arcturians, they have a council, which is basically the Jed Council. they literally call it that. And they see themselves as like guardians of the galaxy. They're more like future humans that have sort of left Earth, you know, a long time ago in their timeline, but they're no longer bound by time because they've moved into a six-dimensional sort of viewpoint and perspective. So I think what's happening is that as humanity starts to balance and starts to transcend beyond duality, that is a key. It's almost like, do you remember in Star Trek where they had this prime directive thing? The prime directive, I think, for planet Earth is there's a Maginot line or a threshold that they're not going to mess with us until we start transcending beyond duality. And then a significant part of the population has to transcend beyond this concept of light versus darkness, you know, sort of black versus white, all these things that we have as polarities in society, which are part of the seven hermetic principles, which they also ascribe and believe to. I think once we start to transcend beyond that, two things happen. We start to perceive higher dimension. And in the context of perceiving higher dimension, our relationship with time fundamentally changes.
Do you know what? You know Robert Lawler's book, The Geometry of the End of Time? Have you studied
Yes.
that?
Mm-hmm.
So he maps that out sort of in different dimensional geometries, which you get into. I mean, 3D is pretty simple. And some of the crop circles actually point to hyperdimensional
tesseracts. Yeah. In fact, there was a tesseract on the 4th of July weekend that showed up. It was one of the ones that I posted in my Telegram group. And which was a tesseract and an explanation, a new mathematical explanation for the imaginary plane of numbers. And the next morning, a tesseract showed up in Wiltshire. And it looked like you would recognize it. It was like a square with a tesseract base center, but then also had overlapping and intersecting waves going around it as well, which is forming somewhat of a torus type of a field.
So you think they're giving us the secrets to things like time travel, wormhole technologies? Is some of these designs showing us this?
I do. And I believe fundamentally that a lot of the stuff that I used to believe required like special machinery, you know, like a time machine or whatever. I realize now that actually we are the time machine. And we don't need other devices to be able to astral projected to experience and to jump into different states of awareness across different dimensions of time space. And that's just the fifth, you know, dimension of our experience that we have not yet experienced en masse, but now many people are starting to experience.
So how do we change the modality of thought? I talk about the difference between cognition and recognition. How do we cognize this fresh way of thinking that will allow us to transcend the old dualistic mind?
I think the answer is actually with the heart. I believe that what's happening right now that humanity is basically traversing through is a transition towards a heart-brain consciousness. So, you know, our hearts actually have brain tissue in them. Around the SA node, which is right up at the top of the heart, right, you know, above the atrial chamber, right, on the would be the right atrial side, you have this bundle of nerves and tissue there that acts a lot like a brain. And this is also where the sodium potassium pump starts in your heart, and it will contract the atrium. And then if you don't have complete heart block, which is a condition you probably don't want to have, then you'll have that same signal go down into your ventricles and pump your ventricles. Now, your brain actually has also the ability to feel, and our heart has the ability to think. So one of my favorite quotes is, when the heart thinks and when the mind feels, the river of wisdom flows.
I'm going to show a little design that was in your film, your little documentary. I think this is what you're doing, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly. So it's a merging of heart and mind. This is the future. Yes. Of humanity. But how do we wake people up to our heart's heart math wisdom is sort of the heart wisdom? How do we, because we are so intellectual, and you're an incredible intellectual too in that way, but how do you remember to drop into that feeling state?
You know, I think that's one of the reasons why I have drawn so much geometry, because that is, you know, if you can look at your brain, on the left temporal lobe is where you are, is your brain center for mathematics. On the right temporal lobe is the brain center for music. So music and math are just two sides of the same coin. But the center point of your brain between those two brain centers of music and mathematics, left brain versus right brain, is the corpus callosum. And that is where geometry is, you know, finds its center. So geometry is this incredible balance between both science and art. And because of that, it strengthens your pineal gland and also will create an electrical canopy on your thalamus, right, in the corpus callosum to connect the left and right brains. So we've been taught in school that everything has to be, to get better in science, you have to study more science. And what I'm going to say to you right now is I don't believe that at all. I believe that's one of the things that's absolutely wrong. It's kind of like, you know, if I were an athlete and I wanted to really be in great shape to run a marathon, I wouldn't only work out half of my body. Balance is critically important. So what we have is like a society where we are so left brain oriented and have been for the last few hundred years that we've lost, you know, we've become almost hypertrophied on that side and atrophied on the other. And we're not practicing empathy. So as a society right now, I think that one of the biggest challenges is that, you know, I often say this, that I don't believe the world's a difficult place because people hate each other. I believe it's difficult and can be difficult because people hate themselves. And mainly the reason why they hate themselves is because they practice no empathy towards themselves. Mm. They're very hard on themselves. And when someone's very hard on themselves, what happens is they project it to everyone around them and they start judging people around them with the things they don't like about themselves. And they're not even consciously aware of it. So coming out of this practice of thinking very left brain and moving into a heart brain awareness requires an opening of the heart, a feeling of empathy. It's a realization that your heart is as powerful as your brain and should actually be the lead on your day-to-day activities. And that requires a rise of the feminine, because the feminine aspect is more akin to the right brain if you're right-handed, and the left brain would be more this rational thought. The right brain is going to be the irrational, the imagination, the creativity, the darkness, and the light is in the left brain. You know, this very much goes directly to the concept of Eye of Ra versus Eye of Horus.
I've heard you talk about that. But do you think there was some kind, I'm not to get too much into conspiracies, but a kind of matrix, a kind of archonic matrix that's been laid over humanity to lock them into non-compassionate left brain rationalism that separated them from the divine feminine? I mean,
you know, I believe fundamentally that we are in a simulation of our own making and that we come here so that we can learn different things that we wanted to learn. I've completely transitioned from the world is happening to me mentality to nothing's happening to me. It's
Oh, I think we lost Robert for a second. There you go. Lost you for a second. Go ahead. What were you saying, Robert? The world is not happening to you. I think you were saying it's happening for you. Are you back online there?
I think he has frozen. So okay. How about this? We can take a little pause here real quick and maybe take a break and show the trailer while we wait for him back in.
Wait, I think he's just come back.
Okay. Yep, I'm back. I'm back.
There we go.
We're having such bad weather here. It's like hard to know what's causing that. Are you guys there?
Yeah, we're here. Can you hear me, Robert?
I sure can. You know, maybe I should get out and come back in. I think that might be better.
Yeah, I think yours is working. Alan's actually frozen now.
Oh, it's Alan's. It's frozen. Okay, I wasn't sure about that.
It seemed fine. Anyways, you were in the middle of a thought. Do you want to just continue with where you are?
Yeah, totally. He's still kind of frozen for me. Is he frozen for you?
Yeah, he's frozen for me, but I'll get him back in right now.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you were saying something about, Alan was saying that you were saying not something happening to you, but something happening for you, right?
So I know it's, you know, it's very easy to think that the world is happening to you when actually I fundamentally believe the world is happening for us. You know, I believe that every experience I've had, if I look back on even the worst, most difficult experiences, actually, I look back at those now and say those some of them were the best experiences of my life because they led to my, you know, biggest challenges that then also yielded for me the greatest learning. And very often that has been the case. I can't think of many cases where a big challenge didn't end up being the best thing that ever happened to me in some way, shape, or form for that point in my life. Are you still there?
Yeah, I was just talking to Alan, getting him back on. And then, So how did this start all connecting with you for ancient civilizations? What was that connection for you at an early age? Did you always have the curiosity with ancient past, or was that something that came a little later?
I definitely always had an interest for ancient civilizations. There's no doubt about that. However, it became a huge thing for me starting really in 2017. I went on a trip to Egypt and it fundamentally changed my life. And, you know, it's become such a great aspect of my life now, where I've derived a lot of fun and enjoyment out of going back and forth to Egypt. I just got back. In fact, you could see my hat on my 3D printer behind me. It's still here. So basically, ancient civilizations for me has been an incredible process to realize and remember who we are. Because I believe that one of the main reasons we come here to this simulation is to learn first and foremost and remember who we are. And then from there, learn how to love and how to receive love.
But what was the purpose of incarnation to begin with? If we came from source, we'd return to source. So why even bother?
I think that the one divided itself into the many simply for the joy of becoming one again. I also believe that each one of us is this incredibly intricate and complex, yet extraordinarily simple design that allows source to experience itself through our eyes. And through each of our individual perspectives. I mean, if you think about it this way, right, this is a geometry that I discovered called a grantahedron. It's a new geometric form. And if you looked at this and said, okay, how many sides are there on here? There's 16 sides, and there are 8 regular pentagons and 8 diamond-shaped pentagons, as you can see here. And they're all golden ratio related. So the length here is 1.618, and this is 1. And all the rest of these are 1, but the pentagon across from here to here is 1.618. You could say that the truth is a multifaceted prism where each of us is able of comprehending, you know, really for most of our lives, only one facet. And that becomes our truth. And then finally, once we expand our consciousness, we realize that what I thought was the truth and factual is actually only one facet of a larger prism of truth. So that means that as I expand my consciousness, if I could take in and understand more than just one facet, the more facets I can comprehend, the more I have expanded my awareness until finally you get to a very, very intricate prism that has billions or infinite number, near infinite number of facets. That is what you think about a source creator would want to experience. Understanding and seeing it through each of the eyes of each of its creation to learn different perspectives to expand its whole experience.
Wow.
And then we reach up to do that, to do that kind of practice, seeing those different perspectives increases our neurological cognitive functions that make us into these divine beings. I think that's where divinity lies. I think that's where you're going with some of that.
I think you're exactly right. And it's really about learning to respect both the masculine for what it brings to the table and what the feminine brings. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful convergence when you really think about it. And the fact that we can all be here to help source consciousness expand its awareness as well, it gives a new purpose to life. It gives a new meaning. And that each one of us also can expand in the same way. Wow. And not only through this lifetime, but through multiple lifetimes. And as we start to expand into the fifth dimension, we start to connect all the dots, not only in this lifetime, but all of our former lifetimes that quite frankly are all actually happening simultaneous to now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Neil, so, you were going to say.
You know, this sounds like, you know, the thousand petal lotus in Indian scriptures. When you were talking about the fractals and us looking at different facets, to me, I feel it's kind of like similar to that. And it's also like if we're so fractalized from the cosmic truth because there's so many fractals towards it, Do you have any, like, do you ever wonder, like, how many fractalizations we are from the truth? Is this one matrix of truth, this one facet, just only one aspect of even a greater part of source, you know? And it's almost like every single galaxy, every single person, we're all destined to do what source originally wanted us to do itself, which is to experience ourselves. So we all become like source creator gods, right?
Yeah, you know, I think the big shift that's about to happen is that the world is going to separate into people that are able to transcend duality. Mm-hmm. And those that transcend are going to be able to live a totally different existence. We've got some bad echo now. I don't know what happened here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that was just Alan. I muted him.
Okay. So those that are able to transcend duality are going to have an entirely different experience on planet Earth. I mean, they'll literally live what's going to feel like a heaven experience. Whereas those who remain in duality and double down on duality, in a way, those that expand into higher dimensions should be thankful to them, because it's also making possible for them to expand into higher dimension, because the universe has to always remain in balance. Every action must have an equal opposite reaction without exception. You look at movies like Lord of the Rings, you know, and the orcs show up in the land at the exact same time that Gandalf becomes, you know, Gandalf the gray that becomes Gandalf the white. And to get that higher degree of magic in the world, you also have to have a higher degree of darkness in the world. The two must always remain in balance. So for every person who's going to go into a higher degree of ascension, right, there has to be an equal opposite reaction in the world. So this remaining in duality, and that's going to be people that are like fighting for Republican or fighting for Democrat or fighting whatever, right? That fighting, that polarity is going to, you know, be very, very dense. It already is very dense. This is why I've stopped like really paying attention to the news. I've stopped like allowing this sort of like, it's almost like mental pollution and frequency pollution into my life, because I just don't want to live that existence. I'd much rather realize that I don't believe that we're here to learn more judgment. I believe we're here to learn to expand our perspectives, to remember who we are, and then learn how to love and be loved. I don't think we're here to learn how to be better judges of the world around us. The context of this world is already judgment. So when we can expand beyond that, then we'll have an entirely different world experience. And, you know, people that are going to be, if you look at all of the comic book films, you know, Batman is a good one. So Batman Begins, and you have this one story about this fellow named Two-Face. You might remember him. And there's a line by Two-Face in the movie where he says, "Hope that you live long enough to defeat the villain, but not so long that you become the villain." Well, actually, it's in every single case, people don't realize if and when they're villains. The villain always believes he's a hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're saying we have to transcend duality, but there's always a equal and opposite reaction, which is a sense duality, but maybe on a higher level, fifth dimensional level, you're talking about entanglement,
yep,
which is thesis about sense duality, because everything's connected. And if we collapse the wave function into things and think in linear ideas, we miss the bigger abstract picture, which is the expansion of multidimensional awareness.
I think it's so difficult because we're all sort of conditioned, I think, to think a certain way. And especially it could be our families or whatever, but we're at that stage, you know, where like Yoda says, you must unlearn what you have learned. And I think that's a very powerful reframing, because once we can do that, then the whole higher dimensional realm is open to us. It's literally with the throat chakra. That is, there are three layers within the throat chakra. There's a self-awareness layer, and not that many people have actually achieved true self-awareness. It's difficult. Even in the business world, they always talk about people. I had a conversation today with the CEO who talked about someone he cared deeply for, but said they were very much lacking in self-awareness. So not that many people actually truly achieve self-awareness. And then the next layer is self-actualization. And very few people really learn how to manifest. And even if they do learn to manifest, it's still dependent on a time function. But as you get to the next layer, the third layer of the throat chakra is called self-transcendence. And self-transcendence is independent of time space. So you can there manifest things literally instantaneously. And it's an entirely different existence, but it requires the transcendence of duality. You have to step out of duality to be able to reside in that space.
And that's what the great masters that you point out were teaching us, what you said about Leonardo da Vinci, learn the art of science and the science of art. I think that's really brilliant from what he says. And then, you know, what da Vinci showed us in art and in science was sort of the unification of the heart and the mind, would you say, right?
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, another way you could put that statement is you could say, you know, learn the brain of the heart and learn the heart of the brain.
Yeah.
And that will allow you to learn how to see.
You talk a lot about the Last Supper and its relationship to the King's Chamber. Did Leonardo ever visit the King's Chamber? How did he know how to align up the Last Supper in relationship to that great
chamber? Leonardo wrote, you know, there are several books of Leonardo's works. One of them is called Codex Atlanticus. And in reference 1336 and 1337, he is written a draft letter to the Devadar of the Lieutenant Devadar of the Sultan of Cairo, Babylon. Now, why would Leonardo write a letter to the Sultan of Cairo? And actually, he uses the term Babylon because Babylon is in Cairo. There's a part of Cairo called Babylon, and it was where Sultan Kite Bey, who was a very famous Mamluk Sultan, which is a class of, it's kind of like during the Ottoman Empire time, these were cousins of the Ottomans. They were based out of Syria, and they got control of all of North Africa, including Egypt. And they put their headquarters in Cairo. And Cairo was largely built up as a metropolitan city at the time by Sultan Kite Bey. Over 250 structures today standing still from 1482 until 1500 were built by, you know, commissions that were put in place by Sultan Kite Bey. He was very heavy in trade and had very strong trade routes, both with Milan and Florence and Venice. And so his boats would dock in Venice, and then you could find paintings in Europe of Sultan Kite Bey's arrival in Europe several times, right? Especially through Venice. Because he was setting out to actually create a very metropolitan, modernized city in 15th century Egypt, he wanted to bring on the very best architects and mathematicians and scholars to help him build this beautiful new city that was his dream. Among those were more than 100 European scholars and polymaths. So if you look at the Babylon fortress in Cairo today, it doesn't look like anything you would imagine from Egypt. It looks exactly like a Tuscan castle. So he hired Leonardo da Vinci, and da Vinci chronicles the story of him being hired by him in this letter. Okay, so this is, there's no dispute as to whether or not da Vinci wrote this letter.
Right.
Now, what is that dispute is what he was referring to, because what the letter basically talks about is his surveying of Mount Taurus. Mm-hmm. Now, most people that are in art history don't know that the original name of the Great Pyramid was Bull Mountain. They also don't know that that's a reference to Osiris, because the Apis bull is Osiris. And the other name of Osiris was the Great Bull of the West. So when you start adding all this up and then realize that the original name of the Giza Plateau was never Giza, but it was Ras Tau, which is Taurus backwards. So now you start to realize, wait, and the description he gives of Mount Taurus is not some mountain in the Armenian mountains or in Turkey. Which, why would he be there to survey when that was under the solid control of the Ottomans, his arch enemies? And actually, you realize that the whole thing was encrypted. He talks about actually having been in a town, it was actually a bustling city, he refers to it as, called Kalindra. There was never a town called Kalindra in Turkey or in Armenia. I've looked, believe me, I've hired historians and everything to look for any reference to a place that had the name Kalindra. Which is like Kali, and the word we get out of it is calendar, right? It's Kali and dragon, right? Kali and dragon. So this Ouroboros, you could think of that as an Ouroboros.
Snake biting its tail.
The snake biting its tail. The cycle of destruction. So on my last trip to Egypt a few weeks ago, I was hellbent to find Kalindra because I knew that it was encrypted, just like everything else. Mount Taurus, right? He refers to the three peaks of the Mount Taurus as being, you know, situated due north, and that there was equal sunlight on the east and the west every day. And it was built of the most amazing and resplendent white limestone. Right. And he's talking about the structure of Mount Taurus. We don't tend to speak about mountain structure.
Right.
Right. Structure implies that there was some intelligent design behind it. And so I started looking for this place called Kalindra. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe because it was supposed to be directly due east of the Nile River. And he had encrypted it, calling it the Euphrates River. And so I started asking around what town there might be there with the name Calendar. And I found that there's a town right next to Babylon. It's literally within 1 minute walk of Babylon and the fortress of Babylon, which is called Calendar.
Wow.
And this town is actually called Ma'adi, which means calendar appointment, like a daily calendar. So I was just like, whoa, unbelievable. Now, this is the same place that Jesus and the Holy Family came to visit twice, not only when Jesus was a small child and escaping from the wrath of Herod looking to kill all firstborn children, but also much later in Jesus' life when he came back with Mary Magdalene and Peter.
But you're saying, Leonardo, evidence from what you found, and you're making incredible discoveries that people looked at for years but didn't put together. So thank you for adding to the history of human civilization. And so Leonardo, probably as a young man, before he became a well-known painter, probably went to Cairo, got into the great...
He was in his 30s. Yep. He was in his 30s.
But not only that, he had such great vision and eyes, were able to see the subtle designs on the walls of the king chamber, like the shape of the cow and the bull, that even thousands of years of visitors or hundreds of years, they didn't notice. But Leonardo, he also saw how the wings of birds would come down. He had such probably a photographic memory to overlay that. Now it makes sense what you're saying, because I didn't get that part when you're talking about the Last Supper relationship to the king's chamber. But now, with this little story, it totally makes sense that that's exactly, and that's evidence. And that's a whole movie right there, Leonardo. Yeah.
Well, what we found is we found so many petroglyphs now on the walls of the King's Chamber, and we made some massive discoveries. And maybe I'll debut some of them at the Portal for Ascension conference, which I think would be kind of really cool. One of them actually relates to DNA and a pretty remarkable discovery there. Actually, these discoveries are literally going to change, I believe, the whole narrative of how we look at what the purpose of the pyramid was and the builders of it even, and the naming of it. You know, while I was there, I've been predicting based on Leonardo's Vitruvian Man. So you have to think about all the paintings after 1486. Because he was there from 1482 to 1486. All the paintings and drawings after that time are actually encrypted with Egyptian symbology.
Right. So
I can name at least five paintings right now that we have discovered multiple encryptions that all relate to the Great Pyramid, the Giza Plateau, and Egyptian symbology, and specifically the story of the death, burial, resurrection cycle and reincarnation cycle of Osiris.
Well, I want to show you my favorite Leonardo da Vinci painting. And I just stands out with sacred geometric forms. Leonardo.
John the Baptist.
The Baptist. And look at the angles from the part in the head to the nose to the chin down to the elbow. But the interesting angle is the shape of his staff, the angle of the cross that leads somewhere. What do you make of this, really?
Well, first of all, if you look to the upper right side there, right by where his hand is, there's a face of a man.
Up in this area, up in the upper.
right in the upper right side. And so you could see a nose right to where his second knuckle would be on his index finger, go directly to the right. And you could see a nose and you could see nostrils and you could see a mouth and then two eyes up on top as well. Right. One of the right eye of which is right underneath this cross. So for me, it's very clear, right? I could see it very, very clear. Mm-hmm. And basically it's pointing up at this face. And it looks like a man who's a little bit bigger, portly kind of a guy. Yeah. But this angle right here of this John the Baptist is also a fundamentally important angle. And the way that he's pointing up as well is obviously telling us something. Another place that we see this finger pointing up is in particular in the Last Supper, where you see Thomas pointing up to the wall, and you're wondering in the exact same way as this, you're wondering what it is that he's pointing at. Why is he pointing there? And you could see, of course, the curls on the hair, but you know, all of these symbologies become really, really important when you look at it as a mosaic. So if you pulled up, in fact, I could do this for you if you like. If you go to Mona Lisa, pull up the Mona Lisa. Let me show you something. And make sure you go to a high-res form of it if you can.
I just want to say one thing about this is the double toroidal form from the right hand and the left hand.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
As above, so is in the heart here with this John the Baptist.
Yep. And he's pointing right to his chest as well. But if you just go to a Mona Lisa, I'll show you something that kind of relates to this.
Yeah, I'll go to a Mona Lisa. But I think in that last painting, he was really trying to show us his final statement. But let me pull up about his insights into the world. Let me just pull up a Mona Lisa here.
Make sure you get the high res Mona Lisa so you can see it really well.
Let me just
Google Mona Lisa high res wiki.
Okay, Mona Lisa high res
wiki.
High res. Okay, let me see if this is it. I think this might be high res here. Let me just see. Okay, let me see if this is it here. Okay, I think let's try that. Okay, let me just go here. Anyway, okay, there. Is that good?
Yep, it is. So if you zoom in a little bit on it, what I noticed over here is if you look to the left of Mona Lisa, mm-hmm. right? So if you take your cursor and move over to the left side, it looks like there's some sort of a letter C hanging out with looks like a chain attached to it.
On the left side, you're saying?
On the left side. Yeah, on the left side. So let me do this. I'll do it because it'll be easier for us to do it. And maybe if you let me share screen, I could pull it up for you.
Okay. Neil, can you let Robert share screen here?
Robert, you can go ahead and share screen.
Okay. Yes. Let me just pull up the image.
Because the reason I think we should go through this is the wisdom of Leonardo da Vinci was showing us something about ourselves in relationship to the universe.
Yes, indeed. So let's have a look at this.
Okay, great.
All right, so here's Mona Lisa.
Right.
Now, as this is downloading, okay. So do you see this shape right here? The strange shape?
Yeah.
This thing right here.
Yeah, yes.
What is that, right? What is that? Why is it there? And then you have the same kind of blackish color behind her back that looks like a hook. Right here.
Yes.
See this?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. What is this? Right. Well, it's interesting because if we now look as well at, let's look at the Vitruvian Man, you might notice something about this that will be kind of remarkable.
Well,
because Vitruvian Man also has something similar.
The other thing I also know about the Mona Lisa Vitruvian Man, the portrait of Leonardo da Vinci, is the shape of that mouth, that kind of strange little, but that's not what you're talking about. There's Vitruvian.
That's right. So if you look at Vitruvian Man, first of all, the first reference to figure out that this was related to Egypt is the 1/14. So the Vitruvian Man, and you can see it's written in backwards mirror text. You see the 1/14 backwards right here.
I do. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So Vitruvian Man was cut into 14 parts. Well, there's another person in Egyptology and ancient Egyptian mythology that was cut into 14 parts, and his name was Osiris.
Right. The original. Right.
So he was cut into 14 parts by his brother Set. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice here that Da Vinci put these horizontal lines on the body to represent the cuts of the body. So he's got 14 lines on here. But what's interesting is on the left wrist, there's, you know, this one line at the wrist and then another one at the elbow and one at the shoulder here. But on the right wrist, there's two lines. There's one here and then there's another one right here. Do you see that?
I do see that. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you see also that it looks like a cuff then? Because you've got a line here and then another line here. It's like he's wearing a cuff of some sort. Okay. And then you can even see when we zoom out, it looks like there's a broken cuff hanging off of it. You see this right here?
Ooh, it's a little dark. It looks like a smudge on the actual image itself.
Yeah, but it's not really a smudge. It's like a broken open C.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Can you see the C right here? It's like a C shape right here. Yeah. And like little dots hanging off of it as well, like a broken shackle. So what I did is I took this same photo. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, well, what happens if I were to take the fingers of Vitruvian Man and assume that that's the width of the Mona Lisa?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then I would place that exactly on top of the Mona Lisa, and I would rest the feet exactly where her hands are resting. Uh-huh. Right here?
Yeah.
Would it by chance have the hand end up going inside this shackle?
Oh. I mean,
and guess what? It does.
He did. How many years apart did he do these, the painting and the drawing?
The drawing was done in 1486 or 87. This was done, it was never done all the way up until, you know, the day of his death. So he kept it with him all the way through his death at Chateau d'Amboise, which is where he met Anne Boleyn.
So,
but basically, see if I might be able to pull it up here. I did some stuff recently that I might not be able to.
We are kept in shackles. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, you know? Or maybe that we have this belief that we are separate, you know, from that we are separate from the feminine, but actually we are always attached to it. There's no way that we are not always attached to it. Mm-hmm. And that's basically, I think, what it's trying to tell us. Let's see if I can find this.
Well, that's also curious why John the Baptist is such an androgynous looking being. That's the murder. Mm-hmm. It's the hierogamos, the holy marriage.
Eros gamos, right, exactly. The holy marriage.
And that's what he's showing us in all his paintings, that we are this interior, this part of ourselves is divine. It's married, the divine feminine. Mm-hmm. And so
exactly. You know, this, I'm going to have to try to find this because I went over my 2 terabyte limit on Apple. So I had to get this other, while I was gone, they had to set up a new hard drive for me for this stuff. But basically what you'll find is that this, it fits perfectly over it. And then the circle of Vitruvian Man perfectly goes into, it basically is right around the crown of the Mona Lisa. It fits exactly perfect. And his hand fits exactly into that shackle. So it's almost like he separated out himself from the feminine. And he thought he was free because the shackle was broken, but now he's inside a box.
Right, right, right.
The freedom is actually when we come back together with the feminine.
So you know what I'm getting from what you're saying, that Leonardo da Vinci created a narrative throughout his imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, the John the Baptist. He's trying to tell us some deep secret about human existence and geometry, art, consciousness. That's sort of what I get about what your discoveries have been.
Say that again. I lost you for a moment.
What I'm getting from your you know, creative insights is that Da Vinci created a narrative of human evolution.
Yes.
From measure of man to the union of the divine masculine.
Union of opposites. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So what does that, what do we learn about ourselves now from looking at your kind of analysis of Da Vinci's work?
I think we learn about ourselves that, A, we're not separate. We are broken into genders, and that's a beautiful thing. And really, we should learn acceptance over judgment of the differences between the genders. We should celebrate the differences between the genders. And we should realize that they're all part of a complementary whole that leads to a divine manifestation and divine ability to realize your own God realization. And that's what I fundamentally believe.
That's the overview. But in the details of Da Vinci's work with the angles and the numbers, he seems like he's giving us a code to discover something even more about ourselves. What would that be, you think?
I think, first of all, as we ascend to higher dimension, one of the first things that we could start to do is remember our past lifetimes. And as we remember our past lifetimes, we start finding things that we leave to ourselves through from different dimensions of time to find in our dimension of time. So literally you find encryptions that you left for yourself, messages through time. So I think a lot of these things are like messages through time. I believe he had access to higher dimension of thought and wisdom. And I also believe that's part and parcel of why he was able to, you know, draw things like a perfect bicycle from like the early 20th century that didn't exist for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's basically what he's telling us, that the concept that we have of time as being a fixed and linear construct is really just a persistent perception that we have. And that actually by expanding our perception, we will have a different experience with time altogether, that time becomes malleable and everything is still retrocausal. So as you raise your frequency, the things that were in your world that were tied to your lower frequency, even in a retrocausal way, will disappear and new things will be replacing them. It's why we have something called a Mandela effect, I believe.
But maybe your work is actually a retrocausal aspect of what Da Vinci planned. So maybe the images of that bull wasn't on the wall of the King's Chamber until you did your work to kind of discover it. And
you know, it could be. That's a mind blower right there. It could definitely be that. I'll tell you this. When I first discovered the Alpha Omega, I was on my way to Egypt, and I told a lot of people I knew I was going to go to Egypt in 2018 and discover something. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I knew I was going to discover something. And I ended up going to Israel for a week first, and then I flew to Egypt, and I drew Alpha Omega in my notebook all the way there on the airplane. It was in my consciousness solidly. When I stood in the King's Chamber with one of my friends laying in the sarcophagus and I looked down at the rim, I had a flashback memory of being there when that Alpha Omega was pressed into the rose granite, not chipped, but pressed into the rose granite. And I looked down to the exact spot that I remembered it in, and there was an Alpha Omega that had never been seen before. So the question is, and then I grabbed the Egyptologist and I said, have you guys seen this before? And the first thing they said was Muhammad Ibrahim looked at me and he said, did you make this? I'm like, of course I didn't make it. Like, when was I going to, like, I just chipped it out right now. It's perfectly 5.605 inches, which is the square root of pi times 10. And the room perimeter is 31.4159 meters. Exactly. So pi times 10 meters. And I was like, yeah, no, I did not chip this out. Come on. So trust me, I've gone back many times and looked at photographs of the pyramid and of the walls of the bull and the cow that my wife discovered and the birds that my assistant discovered. And now we've discovered literally petroglyphs cover all of the walls of all of the pyramids. So our last trip, and you'll be mind blown to see this stuff, literally mind blown. Yeah. And this time, for the first time, not only did we see DNA with nucleotide pairs and everything on the walls, but in addition to that, we also saw we saw scenes that, you know, I will debut in this meeting, which I think will be really amazing. But one thing I will give you a hint on is we saw staff of Hermes everywhere.
Wow. But, you know, so you're going to debut them great at the Portal to Ascension, April 23, mm-hmm. San Diego, ascensionconference.com. Come there. But are you saying that maybe they were later time-coded manifestation? I mean, the Alpha Omega, for instance, that wasn't a symbol the ancient Egyptians knew. So when was that actually carved into the lid of the sarcophagus or the...
Well, we've now confirmed on 37 sarcophagi, every sarcophagus in the Serapeum in Saqqara and every sarcophagus that we reviewed in the Valley of the Kings all had Alpha Chi Omega on them in different positions. And sometimes they were underneath the hieroglyphics. These are much older. Alpha Chi Omega is the symbol on the Arcturian mothership.
But isn't that,
not Greek.
It's not Greek? What?
It's a loan that came much, much older than Greece. So basically the Greek language and the Phoenician language is definitely tied to it, but they got it as a holdover, I believe, from Arcturians who have used that as their symbol on their mothership for as long as people have reported. There are drawings of it that people have put in their books on having their direct experiences with Arcturians. So I believe our entire nature of time is not what we believed it to be. I believe that what we think of as our distant past is actually also our future.
And that's what you're actually seeing manifested in front of you in a way.
Yes.
Because seeing these things materialize on solid granite that no one noticed before. How could it be possible after thousands, hundreds of thousands of tourists over hundreds of years in the King's Chamber? I mean, it's pretty remarkable, I'm saying, that you, because of whatever awareness you have about pattern perceptions, were able to discover something that no one has seen before. It's phenomenal.
And let me share this with you. And it sounds like you've watched Codex. So you did see some of the things on the walls, right? So this is on my website.
And
this is, you can watch this video.
Yeah. Alpha Omega. And you could just make this bigger. Yeah. Full screen. Yes. Good. Click that. Yeah. Okay. This is the Alpha Omega on the rim of the king of in the.
So it's not easy to see until you get the light just right way. So here's the A and here's the Omega.
I see
right
that
here next to it.
I see it.
No one has seen that before. Thousands and thousands of tourists in that King's Chamber.
Yeah, exactly.
To the far wall that or the wall closer to the entrance there.
It's the far wall.
Right. There seems like there's a block on the far wall when I was there also that seemed like it was not.
Yeah, there's like a false block right next to the pyramid. I mean, right next to the sarcophagus. But yeah. I mean, you could see this if you know exactly where to place the light. But I'm telling you, I've been in there many times. Even for me, going in there without having the light in the right way, it is difficult to see this.
Right. So what makes you feel that this is Arcturian language? Where's the connection there?
Because the Arcturian mothership has been reported and been the subject of a few books even to have had the Alpha Chi Omega symbol as its like logo on the side.
So could all of the Greek language be derived from Arcturian, or you think, what's your thought?
You know, it's hard to say, but look, Alpha Chi Omega and Alpha Omega is so old. Even in ancient Egypt, it's older than anything that you could imagine from the standpoint of hieroglyphics. Far, far older. The three oldest places in Egypt are the Great Pyramid Plateau, the Giza Plateau, Saqqara, and the Osirian at Abydos, where the Flower of Life is. And not only are there Flower of Life on the wall, but there's like literally covering all the walls on the pillars at Abydos, the Flower of Life. But there also, we found a very large Alpha Chi Omega that we discovered on the, on the wall at Abydos, which was, you know, really shocking for us because we didn't expect that. And now we found Alpha Chi Omega on every sarcophagus that we have investigated, like every one. It's as if they repurposed all of these sarcophagi from a much older civilization.
Maybe.
And I have no other explanation for it than that, other than we just know that they're all there. Definitely happened that way.
Something else that I heard, you know how the Great Pyramid, the other pyramids had limestone on the outer casing. So it, like Leonardo said, it was a white mountain that shone in the distance. And there was an earthquake sometime, what is in the 14 after, you know, in the 1400s, or maybe after Leonardo was there, 15 or 16, and those limestone casings came down, but there was writing on the limestone that was also in an extraterrestrial language. And you could see that writing in the Mosque of Ali. They took those limestone blocks and built the Mosque of Ali. I think that's what it's called. And you could still see etched in the limestone, this dark script of some looks like extraterrestrial writing. Did you ever look into that?
Yes, I have. And in fact, you know, there's also some other very enigmatic writing that's in the basin underneath the chevrons of the Great Pyramid. There are four, you know, there are four characters, which, you know, some people believe are pronounced Deber or Devere. And I actually think that they're numbers. They could also have pronunciation. In the old days, there were no numbers. We just used letters for numbers. So the letters of the Greek alphabet were also the numbers for Greeks.
Well, that's like the Hebrew is like that too, of course.
Hebrew is exactly like that. But so if you look at this, you can see on this wall here, this is me stylizing it. So I could basically show you this picture. So you've basically got a, let me just see if I can pull this. Whoops. Come on.
Okay.
This All is. Right. So this is our group.
Right.
Is this back?
This is in the Osirian.
This is the Assyrian, right?
Yeah, we're going there with Muhammad Ibrahim, where he's taking us to that too.
Yep. So you could see this. This is the Osirian. You could see an omega shape. These are not chipped into the wall, they're raised. Mm-hmm. So how do you make a raised image as a graffiti?
Yeah.
That's not happening, right? So look at this omega. This is the oldest place arguably in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And look at this. You've got a circle with a line underneath it, omega. You've got a cross right here. It looks like there's a rose in the center of the cross, and they're raised. And then you've got an indented A right here with a line coming across. So it looks just like this.
Yeah.
So this was the moment we discovered it, our group did.
Yeah. No, that. So you're saying these are Arcturian imprints of like saying this is who was here that it's just recently been discovered because we're ready to meet this level of consciousness.
You know, that part of it, I don't know. But what you can see here as well is you could see what looks like the trunk of a tree. Yeah. The indentation on the wall looks like there's a trunk coming out of the block where the chi is, or the X, right? And you could see it looks like a tree right here, even. Can you see this part that looks like the trunk of a tree and then it kind of grows out this way? So you've got an Alpha Chi Omega. I don't know why it's basically showing up to us now. It could just be that we're now able to see some of these higher dimensional things because we're noticing the subtleties and we know what to look for. Whereas before, maybe the conditioning bias was such that people weren't looking for anything, but you can see it. Just watch this for a moment quietly, and you'll be able to listen to what everyone's saying, because I wasn't even the one who discovered this. You know, this is like a very, very interesting circumstance that happened right here.
That's a cross. That's a cross. Right here. Oh, yes. Here. That's a cross. Yes. Alpha Chi Omega.
And what's funny is I'm wearing an Alpha Chi Omega shirt.
But what does Alpha Chi Omega means, the beginning and the end? But why is that talking to? What does it really mean on a symbolic level for our today's consciousness?
I think what it means is the representation of the return of the divine. That this separation of, you know, we've had this yin-yang world of duality. And now we've moved into a new paradigm, which is one of yin, shen, yang. Shen being the X. It's the crossover. It's like when masculine multiplies by feminine. It's not just plus, it's plus and multiplication. And then something really magical happens with that. And there's a return to divinity and a return to the understanding of what our real destiny is.
Neil, does rewrite ancient history? I mean, you're a student of history, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love everything you're sharing, Robert, because, you know, this is kind of information I'm attracted to. It's really full circle awareness, right? Like, to me, the word ascension doesn't just mean some spiritual tools and vibration. It's everything, ancient civilizations, the mathematics, the science of the cosmos, you know, and you're really bringing it all into what it all means. These are all different facets that we're bringing together in order to piece together those pieces of the puzzle, like you showed, those different fractals. And from all those avenues, we get a greater understanding of who we are and where we came from and what we're here to do, right? So there was one other thing that you shared that really stood out for me. And you said, maybe we can close out with, you know, answering to this a little bit. You said our distant past is also our future. And to me, this kind of feels like you're saying maybe that we've been incarnated into these lower dimensions by beings that we eventually become as we evolve into our future. So what are your thoughts on that? What does
that
mean? I think
that's exactly right. I don't think that there, I think the funny joke on all of us is that this is not about blaming anyone else. I think it's really what we chose. And, you know, one of my favorite Chinese proverbs is the man who blames others has a long way to go in his journey. The man who blames himself is halfway there. And the man who blames no one has arrived. I think there's deep wisdom in this. So let me just show you this, because I promised on this, I wanted to show you this related to the Mona Lisa. And you can see here,
trying to draw some conclusions.
The same thing.
Place this on top of, right, using the exact same proportions.
Sorry, just so I get my head around this correctly, Robert. The omega is kind of pointing inward, it's not pointing downward.
See it right here? It goes right over his wrist.
The omega.
Yeah, and it's an omega. The letter C is an omega shape. It's the exact same shape as the one in the pyramid.
That's the beginning and the end.
So when you match the Vitruvian man's fingers to the width of the Mona Lisa, and you rest his feet on the same place that her hands are resting, then the head is perfectly inscribed within the Vitruvian man's circle. You see that?
That is an incredible discovery that changes art history. I say it makes Leonardo's paintings a narrative of conscious awakening, in a sense.
Indeed it does, which is why we've all been so enigmatically intrigued by it. And look also at the eye of Horus, the left eye of Mona Lisa, and it ends up exactly at the crown chakra of Vitruvian Man. You see that? Like literally right there. How beautiful is that? That's like mind-boggling. And, you know, I think it's such an amazing, amazing thing that we can see now. And, you know, another thing that points us to Osiris, not only the 14 cuts, but when we realize as well that we can take the Salvator Mundi and what are these three stars? And look at this. The reflection of his hand is actually the Great Pyramid.
You
can see the ridge line on it as well. And then those three stars happen to match exactly the top three stars of Orion. The top three stars of Orion, right? Which is Betelgeuse, Mintaka, and I forget the other, Bellatrix, I think is the other one.
And so what about those three stars? Is he pointing to our destiny or?
No, he's basically saying that this whole Giza plateau, right? We already know that the position of the three pyramids is the belt stars. And what he's pointing to is that this is all about Orion. It's all about Orion. Here's another way to look at it right here.
I see. Yeah, I see those stars right there. Yeah.
Wow. And what kind of triangle is that, making the specific triangle too?
Yeah, this is the top three stars of Orion. So you could basically put, well, I guess I thought I had that. Hang on a second. Maybe it's this one.
What, you know, you have so much to share with our audience in San Diego, Robert. This is just getting me really excited about discoveries you're going to continually make about the stars, the history of art, consciousness, who we are, the divine nature. I mean,
absolutely. Look, here we go. Can you see this right here? Yeah. Here's Orion. Those are the top three stars of Orion. It fits perfectly right on top of this thing that looks like the pyramid, which is his hand.
Wow.
It's even got a ridge line up here in this pyramid, right? I mean, it's pretty clear. And the whole thing here is about Christ consciousness and achieving the X, the Shen. So you can see the other stars all fall outside of the ball, right? They're like right on the rim, on the edge. Yeah. So you just wouldn't be able to see them. But basically, those are the top three stars of Orion. Again, telling us the connection back to Orion and the man with 14 cuts.
And I'm sure you have some maybe we can talk about that another time. But I'm sure you have some opinions on why they're pointing to Orion, right?
Because Orion represents, and we found that on the pyramid walls as well, Orion represents this death, burial, resurrection, and reincarnation cycle that mankind went into, right? And that's really what it's all about. And now it's about us. You know, here's another way to look at this. You know, Mona Lisa's eye shows up right on top of Vitruvian Man's head. Mm-hmm. And the space that fits between her eye and the top is exactly the moon.
Oh.
Wow.
Wow.
Beautiful. It's beyond art. It's like an activation code. Just by looking at this art, I feel it activates us.
Yeah, it's just like geometry does the same thing. And here's that same shackle right here, you know, and you could see there's a faint outline of a letter A here as well. All of his paintings and works are encrypted. And this was the story he's telling. Here's the Alpha Omega on the rim of the sarcophagus. If we look at the Last Supper, the exact position where Jesus is sitting and his shape is the Alpha. It's the shape of Alpha. So here's the letter A right here. And then on the garment of Mary Magdalene, you can see the faint outline where I'm tracing right here of an Omega.
Well, I want to have a whole conversation with you just about the sacred geometry between the moon, the sun, and the earth. I mean, that's something that we can go into, and how that's an Alpha Chi Omega relationship.
Just like Vitruvian Man is. We found the faint outline of the Alpha on his left wrist, and his right wrist has the Omega that's broken open. The broken Omega, the broken feminine. And basically that's what we're discovering here, is how to reunite and find this divinity within, which is, this is a statue that I made as a sculptor, right? And I didn't even try to match the proportions, and you could see it's not that far off, and the face especially is pretty amazing how close it is to Vitruvian Man's face. Look at that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know we can talk to you for hours, but what do you want to talk about at the conference coming up in San Diego? Some of this stuff, or what would you like to share about your recent work there?
You know, I think that all of this is just pointing us to remember who we are. And I think that's why, as soon as we start to do that and transcend duality, then the intraterrestrials that are already here are going to be very much available to our perception.
Yeah, I mean, it is about transcending duality, but there's something so sophisticated and deep about these designs that it feels like codes. It feels like ways of activating the neural networks to perceive those levels of transcendence. And maybe that's what your work is about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that the geometry is the most powerful aspect of this. You know, one of the most recent things that I had discovered, and I just posted on it last night, in fact, is what I'll show you now. And it relates to the central geometric and architectural plan of the Giza Plateau, which derives all three pyramids simply with starting with a simple circle and a line of the same length. So a circumference of a circle of the same length of a line which is matching that same circle and rod that you see in all of the ancient Sumerian reliefs, right, and petroglyphs. And you'll see that this actually becomes some form of a code that we can understand how the pyramid is actually built too. So just starting with this circle and a line, those are both 432 in length. From there, yeah. I just put another circle on top of it. Now I have the Great Pyramid. That is exactly the proportion with the precise slope angle of the pyramid. But it doesn't just stop there. It now goes to Khafre as well. The second pyramid can be constructed without any measurement, just using the simple method that I posted up last night.
Is that 51 degrees, the angle of the...
It's 51.853974 degrees. It's perfect. And that allows you to square the circle. So this square has the exact same perimeter value as the circumference of this circle, because it's the half base. And from that, you can also find Khafre pyramid in proportion to Khufu without any measurement. Wow. I can draw all of this with only compass and straight edge. I don't need any measurements on a ruler to be able to derive this. And
I just heard that 51.3 degrees is the structure of bone, the angles of the calcium in the bones is that 51 degrees. That makes sense, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that could, well, I'm not aware of that as an angle, but I'll have a look at the structure of the calcium angle. But basically what this does is, you know, the three different pyramids have three different degrees. The Great Pyramid's 51.85397. You can see it right here on the right. The Khafre Pyramid is 53.13, and the Menkaure Pyramid is 51.34. And those are musical ratios. So this is and if you know music, this is a major third, a 5/4 Pythagorean interval. And then you have a perfect fifth that sits inside of this, and a perfect fourth, because it's inverse of the perfect fourth, which is 4/3, is going to be exactly the perfect fifth as well, right? Which is 3/2. So half of this four becomes, it inverses the other direction. And then the Great Pyramid becomes 2/π. So we've got 5/4/3/2 pi. So pi is being another way of looking at the circle or one. So 5/4/3/2/1, you've got the tetractys, and these are all musical intervals that exist, are available in the Great Pyramid, Khafre Pyramid, and Menkaure, just in their base to their height ratios. It's all musical interval. It's like the rainbow spectrum of light and sound is what we're looking at when we look at the Giza Plateau.
It's a whole other conversation, but I'm sure you have a theory about the bent pyramid and the different angles that are happening.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. We've analyzed that to a very, very high degree. The upper angle of the bent pyramid is 43 degrees, 22 minutes. And that's 432. And 432 is the foundational basis of the measurements that were used to build not only the pyramids in Giza, but the pyramids in Mexico as well. The base of the Pyramid of the Sun in Mexico is identical to the base of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, 756 feet.
Robert, let's go into some of this deep stuff at the conference that Neil has to jump off. But I really could talk to you for days about all this because the work. And how do people find you and your books and your work?
You can find me on Instagram. I have books on Amazon. I'm very happy and lucky that my book called Philomath has been still the number one. This weekend, it was still, after 2 years of being released, the number one book in number theory on Amazon, and also in geometry, general geometry. I have a new book that just came out called Polymath, which is really about all of these. It analyzes all the impossible geometric forms, and they're not supposed to be possible at all, and uses it as a reference point for mankind ascending beyond what he believed was possible. And what he and she believed was possible. And you can go to my Instagram page, which is just Robert Edward Grant on Instagram. And on my website is the same, robertedwardgrant.com.
I can't wait to see you at San Diego, because there's going to be a lot of brilliant people there who understand what you're talking about. Robert Schott, JJ and Desiree Hertog, Michael Cremo. These are all investigators into the ancient knowledge. So we're going to have an incredible conversation about ancient civilizations there. Neil, anything else you want to say about the conference?
Yeah, and you're also going to be on the panel with the ancient history panel with all of, with her Hertog, Linda Moulton-Howe and everything. So, you know, maybe we can go deeper into these specific questions on the panel as well.
Oh, happy to. Yeah. Totally happy to. So very excited for this conference and looking forward to meeting you guys in person.
Thank you. Appreciate you, brother. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
Love this conversation. I'm going to watch it again because there's so much in there.
Oh, yeah. It's dense. It's dense. So, but yeah, definitely Codex is another thing I wanted to say is that if you're interested in these types of things, you can find me on Gaia on Codex, which has done remarkably well. And I'm really thrilled, but I think you're right. The story is about to go really, really big. I feel that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.